Okay, since there is an unscheduled break after my talk, I'm not going to worry about the time. I'm not going to pull myself off the stage. I don't think it'll be too long, though, so don't worry. I work in at the University of Wyoming, and we have a pretty active reclamation and restoration program there associated with the Wyoming Reclamation Restoration Center and the School of Energy Resources there at Wyoming that funds quite a bit of work. So I'm going to talk about some of the issues that we face with the oil and gas boom in high desert basins in southern and southwestern Wyoming. Wyoming is in the northern Rockies. There's no pointer here, huh? Can I have it? I can't move without a pointer. Sorry. Should have got you then. Laramie's down here, the northern end of the southern Rockies, the Medicine Bow, the Wind River Range, and then we're working in the upper Green River and Great Divide Basin. So the Great Divide Basin is where the Continental Divide comes here and it splits and forms an internally drained basin that's very arid. A lot of saline aridisols and entisols. So the objectives of a lot of our work have been really to determine the nature of these soils that are sort of set back to zero soil development and what's going on with that. And the soils are formed in saline and sodic marine shales in many of these basins, or the alluvium derived from those formations. This is a Wyoming soil map based on the Statsco database, and I've just highlighted some of the areas with real problem soils. These are playas with saline soils, and then sodic soils, mainly in alluvial deposits and alluvial and residuum from the those marine shales. This just shows some of the oil and gas pipelines, and then oil and gas active wells in red, and plugged and abandoned wells in blue. So there's thousands of wells, and there's a real oil boom going on down here right now, and in the Powder River Basin again. So this is a huge issue, and it's not going to go away. And these saline and sodic soils make reclamation a real challenge here. And this is only part of the picture. There's all kinds of infrastructure with this: roads, pipelines to almost every well, gas plants and condensation plants. So there's just a lot of disturbance. This is the Upper Green River Basin, the Pinedale Anticline gas field, and the Jonah. The Jonah has one of the highest density of wells, and also it's one of the oldest fields in the state. This is what the Jonah looks like in a Google Earth shot. So a lot of disturbance on these areas of both kind of these plateau tops with older residual soils, and then the eroded side slopes that are probably the entisols that are also very challenging to get something growing in. The Wamsutter area with many wells on some of these problem sodic and saline soils. These are two of our study sites on this Red Lake area, which is alluvial old playa deposit. Saline and sodic conditions. So I'll be talking more about these study sites. And this is what that Red Lake looked like last spring when we got a great bloom of lomatium biscuit root. And, you know, this is about as green as it gets out there. pretty uniform in this case. In some cases, there's a lot of heterogeneity in the soils, and that's one of the big challenges for reclamation as well. So we're in aridic moisture regimes, frigid temperature regimes, with coefficient variations for both of those areas in the 30% range. So it goes from, you know, absolutely, basically no precipitation to pretty good years. Like in 2011, we had some research to try to get things growing. It rained a lot, and everything we did worked, so it was great. But even our controls worked well, where we didn't, all we did was plant the seed. But then, since then, we've had some extreme droughts where these salts move to the surface and destroy what I'm going to refer to as the germination zone that's so important for native plant establishment. So just to run through kind of the standard operating procedure for reclamation on these oil and gas wells, the first step, and it's kind of a one-size-fits-all. I think they do it the same in Virginia as they do in the Great Divide Basin. So first they do some soil assessment to measure the depth of the suitable growth medium, and it's mapped out in a very blocky way like this with the amount of soil that can be salvaged, and it's based on not on fertility or organic matter content, but basically the lack of too much clay or too much gravel or too much salinity that makes it unsuitable for salvage. So there's really no parameter about organic matter even looked at in that. So they use these big scrapers, and they just go around and around and dump the material in a stockpile, and then they spread it back out the same way. They just pick it up and go around and around and spread it back out. They'll remove the subsoil if the site needs to be leveled. They'll remove the subsoil and stockpile that separately. And then most of the oil and gas development is managed by the Bureau of Land Management, United States Department of Interior Agency, and they require native plants to be planted. So the next step is they do deep tillage to try to alleviate compaction, and then they plant with these range drills. And this is what's called interim reclamation. So the infrastructure of the well is still there. It might, all that happens usually within a summer. They get done drilling the well. The well goes into production, and then that might be that way for 30 to 50 years, and then they come back and do final reclamation. So what happens to the soil during that process is one of our big questions. Well, one of the problems is that, the soils here are very shallow. These are some of the more well-developed natrargids, so natric horizons very close to the surface, even though this would be sort of one of those soils formed in residuum. But we got a big jump in clay within 10 centimeters, and then a natric or sodium-rich horizon within about 13 centimeters on the typical pedon there. This is more like the alluvial sort of playa situation, where we have very high pH all the way to the surface, and then a clay accumulation within 10 centimeters. So if we say we can have a good operator and we can salvage that to 15 centimeters, we still end up really diluting the organic material that's concentrated at the surface and mixing it with clay and sodic material below. So at the Jonah Field, you can almost see it, we sampled four well pads. We started pre-disturbance. We sampled deep into these large stockpiles. of topsoil, all the same soil through the process. So, and then we sampled it right after it was respread, and then a year later. We analyzed this for potentially mineralizable carbon and nitrogen by a 14-day aerobic incubation, and then mineral nitrogen as well. And then those are the things I'm going to talk about for this study today. And at the, this is what one of those Red Lake sodic saline or saline sodic sites looks like. And we did paired site studies at a number of well pads here in the Wamsutter area. And we were, one of the main things we were interested in here was soil structure. So high sodium contents tend to destroy soil structure. So we looked at dry aggregate distributions and wet aggregate distributions. And we also did some amendment studies, and there'll be a poster that I'll mention again that my student Samantha Day will present after this session. So for the at the Jonah Field, pre-disturbance in these Wyoming big sagebrush steppe plant communities, very low concentrations of mineral nitrogen, which is what we expect, kind of immobilizes rapidly in those plant communities. The potentially mineralizable carbon here is on the right-hand scale, so it's 10 times higher than the mineralizable nitrogen on the left. When we salvage that soil and put it in a stockpile, we end up, we get a big pulse of nitrate, but we also saw pretty consistently we would see also big jumps in potentially mineralizable carbon and nitrogen. Now this is carbon and nitrogen that is, I think of it as kind of this protected pool, because if we pick it up when we disturb it and put it in our incubation jar, that means that it wasn't mineralized in the field, so it was protected. And through this disturbance process, I think we end up with accessing more of that when we put the material in the jar, because it that belly scraper just, you know, pulverizes the soil. But also, it mixes up all the plant material on the site and pulverizes that right along with it. So that's probably contributing to this surge of potentially mineralizable carbon and nitrogen. Then when we measured the reclaimed site, we saw another big pulse of mineralization, and it looks like that material, that mineralizable carbon and nitrogen, then mineralized. When we spread that stuff back out 15 centimeters deep, it's got access to oxygen. So going into the stockpile, we get a pulse here, but we kind of put it in cold storage in those big stockpiles. It's done when the soil's fairly dry, I don't think much happens while it's in the stockpile. Then when we spread it out, repulverize it, access to oxygen and moisture, and we get this big pulse of mineral nitrogen at the expense of the mineralizable pool. So what happens to that? Well, a year later, guess what happens? We get a huge amount of weed production responding to that. That's a lot of available nitrogen. I think based on our bulk density values, we came up with in the neighborhood of 50 pounds per acre of fertilizer out there. And then some companies will go and fertilize. I think they've pretty much quit doing that because of this material, obviously. But they've also seen that they get even more weeds when they fertilize. So, and then the mineralizable carbon and nitrogen, with the weeds and the materials going into the soil, starts to make a recovery. So weeds, depending on what they are, a lot of reclamationists actually like tumbleweed. It's a good cover crop, they say, although it, you know, tumbles away and takes a lot of the resources with it. So at the Wamsutter field, we looked at loss of total soil organic carbon, and we lost, you know, upwards of 60%. That's due to a combination of the mineralization like we saw in that previous slide, and then just mixing of that very thin A horizon with material below it down to, they shoot for 15 centimeters, but that's a challenge in those great big machines. So a texture went from the two sites at Wamsutter were in the green, so a loam and clay loam, silty clay loam prior to disturbance, and moved to a clay loam and a clay with almost, in that case, almost 60% clay. So you can imagine what that's going to do to structure and porosity. We measured salinity at the saline sodic site. So these sites were not saline and sodic prior to disturbance, but after they do classify as saline and saline, sodic and saline sodic. So we got a huge jump in sodium content, especially in the really difficult site, and a huge jump in the exchangeable sodium percentage. So that indicates what we also saw, and I'm not presenting, is that we also got an increase in calcium, magnesium, potassium salts, but not nearly in the proportion that we did of sodium. So we ended up with a much higher exchangeable sodium percentage. But then overall salinity also increased a great deal. So you can see an EC of 4 is what they call the cutoff for a saline soil. So that's why this soil is not saline, but it is sodic, because it's got a high ESP. This soil is sodic and saline, so it's kind of the double whammy as far as management issues and reclamation issues. So in dry aggregate size classes, we just saw kind of a flip. I did this on as a line graph, so you can see that in the undisturbed condition, we have much lower amount of these large cloddy aggregates, and then a much more micro aggregates, and then it flips after disturbance. So we get much more cloddy soil. The wet aggregates weren't really affected at all at the sodic site, but at the saline sodic site, we lost a lot of micro aggregates, and then this is basically dispersed material, and that jumped way up after. So the upshot is this pulse of mineralization leads to weeds. This is an infestation of halogenin, which in itself increases salinity as it deposits. It's able to pull saline soil solution to the surface and then deposit it there. And this was pretty much a championship stand of halogenin on the saline sodic site. And that represents really lost nutrients. That big mineral end pool is just sort of squandered when we see this happen. We lost the soil organic matter. We pulverized the structure. We end up with a finer texture, increased salinity and sodicity. So we get these wicked soil crusts that if plants do germinate, they can't force their way through it. We lose porosity, we lose infiltration, and we end up with failed reclamation. So we really start with a new time zero. If this is organic matter profile at the before disturbance, it ends up being more like this with corresponding increases in clays and salts. And then we're shooting for a remediated germination zone that might look something like that. So I'm just going to quickly mention some of the projects we've done. We did controlled livestock impact. Ranchers are very interested in this, as using livestock as a tool. We put 100 head per acre for 24 hours and fed them hay in these little pens. We actually had 25 head on a quarter acre, made it a lot easier. And we saw immediate pulses in all these indices of soil quality, these labile organic matter pools, that by the following spring had dropped back down to controls. But if you do this right after seeding, I think, you know, it gives it a boost, and we did see a positive effect on grass germination. We've incorporated straw, so we didn't do a mulch. We actually disced in straw, and we saw a real effect on that pulse of nitrate and weed production. In this case, we also got a bunch of volunteer barley from the straw that acted as a cover crop, I think. That was that 2011 study when everything grew. My student Steph Cute will be given a poster on this project today and a talk tomorrow morning at 8:15. He's looking at these little basins, and he's actually putting a sand capillary barrier with underneath a biscuit of soil plus seed. I don't know what else to call it. I guess he calls it a pie. And then a sand mulch over that. So the idea is we get a little bit longer moisture period. So using soil physics, jumped out of my head. What is that principle, Frank? Two different particle sizes on top of each other. So we trap moisture a little bit longer in that, right, with capillary barriers above and below. And it's also a salt valve, so as moisture infiltrates, it'll reduce the EC in that seed-soil mixture, we think. This is Mark Ankeny's brainchild here, and Seth has really made it work, at least made it so we can evaluate it. Samantha Day has done this big compost plus chemical amendment project that she presented on yesterday, and we'll have a poster today. We can really decrease the ESP and improve soil structure with things like langbeinite and gypsum, but we really see an increase in salinity, and we're hoping that that's sort of a short-term effect, that the improvement in soil structure will sort of jumpstart recovery of these things. And we haven't seen any effect of the compost yet, but we're hoping that we do. And last, we now are really thinking about the idea that, okay, should we really jump to like this late seral plant community with long-lived bunch grasses and shrubs, or should we start with the more what you would have seen before cheatgrass and before the halogeton invasive weeds? So plant really loading up the seed mix with native annuals that are more aggressive, can act like a cover crop and utilize that pulse of nitrate and cycle it with a plant that's more desirable than some of the weeds. This is bee plant, one that's used pretty often, but we would want to see a lot more of it mixed with other native annuals, including sunflowers and other forbs like that. I really think we have to start thinking about some new directions, though, instead of this one-size-fits-all approach. And just some of the things we talked about are trying to figure out other machines that might pulverize the soil a little less, some kind of machine that would pick up the top surface without destroying, without completely pulverizing, just reducing disturbance. So some companies use oak mats. There's certain situations or certain times where you might not have to salvage. You can just drive on the soil without doing as much damage as you would if you salvaged it. But I think what we really need is more of a prescriptive approach where we develop optimal reclamation methods depending on what kind of fragile soil and plant community you're in, and instead of the one-size-fits-all. So this is Calvin and Amber on one of our study sites. They look like they're smiling, but they really have their helmets tightened up so much that those are grimaces because the wind is always blowing. So with that, I think I went over time, but we have a break right now because our next speaker couldn't make it. So I'm willing to answer any questions, or I think Abby would probably consider answering some more questions too. Yes, Frank.
So after that first year where it's the lead establishment, do you follow that beyond it and then see?
Good question. No. We have proposals out right now to revisit all these sites that we've been doing the last 5 or 6 years and try to see, you know, what's happening in the longer term. But our grant cycles we sort of run out of money, and we do drive by these areas and we see some that are working and some that aren't, and we need to do a lot of follow-up. That'll really, I think, provide some good information. Yes?
What are the diversity requirements that you'd like to add more annual, but to increase the diversity, but it's not required at this point?
Well, there's forb and shrub requirements in the seed mix, but a lot of them aren't these annuals. That they're not. That's not what they're using so much. And we're just thinking if we load that up almost like a cover crop, that could start to jumpstart the soil development, the development of that germination zone. Maybe plants that are tolerant of salinity. So
better than tumbleweed.
Yeah, although, you know, there's one reclamationist that's really good at what he does, and he's been trying to prove that tumbleweed's native because he likes it so much as a cover crop. Even though
it does work as a cover crop.
Yeah, that's what he claims, and a lot of the reclamationists do. It's called Russian thistle, though, so I think
it's not.
Yes? No, well, it probably is, but not intentionally. It's got a very tiny seed, produces thousands and thousands of seeds, and it's really strange stuff. I mean, in a dry summer, you go out there and you can wring water out of it. It's very succulent, so it's bizarre. It turns bright red. So, do you know where it's native to?
It's Asian.
Asian.
Like Russian.
Yeah. Right, cheatgrass.
So is that on the sodic?
That halogene?
Yeah.
Yeah, that I think that big lush stand that we showed, that was the saline sodic site, right?
That was the sodic.
Okay, the saline sodic site was so, the salinity and the sodicity were both so high that I don't think halogene even did well there. Although it was growing there, but not to that extent. All right, thank you. Yeah.
What's the natural disturbance in the area?
Sorry?
What's the natural disturbance regime for plants? Is fire prevalent or not anymore?
I don't think most of those plant communities, maybe in the rare year when there was, you know, a lot of precip and a lot of biomass, they would carry a fire, but for the most part, I don't know. Edie, do you know was there any natural disturbance regime? I mean, grazing has been for the last couple of centuries.
They don't do it grazing before that then, too?
Yeah, there's antelope out there now, but and there's elk sometimes, but I'd have a hard time imagining it being a disturbance regime.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there is. There's Gardner's saltbush and those little forbs like that biscuit root that I showed. So there's a native plant community there now.
They lined it out.
Yeah, and then on the edges of that, there's stabilized dunes that are covered with sagebrush with the Gardner saltbush in between. It's a really interesting plant community in a way.
So does that go into your seed mix then, Gardner saltbush?
Yeah, it is in the seed mixes. But they, you know, they in those areas where there's islands of sagebrush on stabilized dunes, they just mix everything together, and then you end up with a mixed soil that's not really good for sagebrush or gardener saltbush, I think. But the soil is too thin in between those stabilized dunes to even salvage, so they take 18 inches from the dunes and a little bit maybe from in between, and stir it up and spread it back out. So it's kind of a broad brush approach. And that's another thing we're proposing, is more separation. I mean, that's hard, but, you know, I think they make a lot of money getting gas out of the ground, so I think they could take a few more steps to make it more successful.